Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Christian, and this is the Ice Age Farmer Podcast. As you know, given the many threats to our food supply as we enter this great reset, it's imperative that we all grow our own food to provide for our families and for our communities. This is much easier said than done, though, and so today I'm thrilled to welcome Marjorie Wildcraft to the show. Marjorie became passionate about food security some years back, and we'll hear why today. So passionate, actually, that she gave up her career as a manager of a successful investment company so that she could focus completely on learning about the fastest and easiest ways to grow food. After some years exploring organic farming, permaculture, agroforestry, indigenous techniques, and even spending some time with the crazies living barefoot and illegally in national forests, she pulled it all together and codified a system to grow half of your own food in about an hour a day. So today, we'll explore that system through a lens of this renewed sense of urgency, given the challenges facing us immediately. And we'll share some data that is quite amazing and I think uplifting about just how quickly we could render all of the big ag and industrial factory farming, all of that could be rendered obsolete overnight if even only a fraction of us really turned our attention to growing food. That's great to hear that we actually can make a meaningful difference out in our backyards. So I hope you find this conversation as inspiring and as fun as I genuinely did. And more importantly, I hope it arms you with everything you need to walk outside right now and make the world a better place, starting right there in your backyard. Before I begin, I want to thank you for your support, your help in spreading the word about this broadcast, and your support very much makes it all possible. So if you find value in my research and in interviews like this one, you can find a few different ways to help out the broadcast at iceagefarmer.com/support. So now, without further ado,
Marjorie Wildcraft, thanks so much for joining me here on the Ice Age Farmer podcast.
I am so delighted to be here, Christian. Yeah.
I'm delighted to have you. I have been looking forward to our conversation for some time. I've been wanting to get you on. And then when you reached out to me last week, I just knew that we needed to have this conversation and the time was right. I want to start by thanking you for all of your work. You know, for many years, I've been watching all of it and, going back to interviews from 2011, even you've been talking about GMOs and seed sovereignty and all of the fighting the good fight for a long time. So on behalf of everyone listening, thank you for that genuinely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's good. I'll take a little acknowledgement. I'm working most of the time, so I don't even think about it. But yeah, great.
Yeah, you're busting it. No, and we appreciate that. And now is the time I think everyone has, you know, this is they're all in on what's going on right now. So everyone really needs to step up to the plate and do whatever it is they can, given their skill set. So let's then, given that depth of experience that you've had and that passion, we need to leverage that right now more than ever. So I think my audience is familiar with the many threats to our food system. And I know many of my audience, because when I asked if anybody had questions for you, I got more than ever. So everybody loves you and knows you already. But even for the, let's just say for the one or two people out there that haven't heard of you, would you mind just briefly introducing yourself and sort of telling us what got you started thinking about food security?
Sure. So first of all, I'm the founder of the Grow Network. And we are an online community of people who are stopping the destruction of the earth via homegrown food. Now, that really is the fundamental thing. And but I didn't go into it because of that, actually. I went into it out of fear and panic. I was completely freaked out. Years ago, I was a student of a guy named Robert Kiyosaki, who later became very famous for the Rich Dad, Poor Dad series of books. And but wow, that'd be so cool to have money make money. I like that idea, right? And I basically built a whole real estate investment business based on his principles. And in fact, I was the lead testimonial on a couple of his Time Life infomercials, which I'm not exactly so proud of that anymore, but you know, whatever. So I was, you know. And so anyway, if you're going to make money in real estate, the way you do it is with OPM, and that is other people's money. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do is I would find the deals, I would structure the deals, we'd put them in limited partnerships, I'd find somebody like a you know, an old friend who was a vice president at a multinational, or my local dentist, or, you know, somebody with some money, and we'd get together, we'd buy houses, and we'd put them in this limited partnership, and I would structure it, and we were basically buying houses and then selling them on a wrap. And it dawned on me one day that my biggest partner was actually Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I was looking at their business model one day, and I was like, oh my God, no, real art. Hey, wait a minute, everybody, we got to stop here. We got to stop. You know, I've been climbing the ladder, and it's a classic, you know, the ladder is leaning up against the wrong wall. You're like, wait, yep. I think we got to backtrack. So fortunately, I dismantled that whole business after building it, and the final pieces of that were taken apart about 2003, 2004. So I was a little early for 2000, but better early than late, right? Mm-hmm. And when I saw all the talking heads and everything that went on in 2008, I was like, just bad deja vu. Like, it was really bad. But so I got really interested, and, you know, I could see that the potential for global economic collapse was there because of the way Wall Street slices and dices all those combined mortgage-backed securities and everything like that. And I said, well, what happens in economic collapse? I mean, like, do we all just keep doing what we do, but we push a wheelbarrow full of money? In which case, if I get a wheelbarrow, I'm going to be good, right? I'll be prepared, right? Well, it turns out that it really is good to have some defense and to understand how to shoot a gun and, you know, practical. And it is really good to have some medical skills. But the biggest thing, after reading just tons of novels and journals and, you know, books, historical accounts, and then also interviewing people who had survived economic collapse, civil war, different collapse situations, even traveling to different places that had collapsed, the number one thing they all talk about is being hungry. Mm-hmm. The food supply is always the thing that breaks and has the most impact. And so, yeah, it is hard to get medicines, and yeah, violence does go up, but starving to death is the biggest problem you're going to face in any kind of collapse situation. So I said, well, I better learn how to grow food, right? Mm-hmm. Might be a good idea. And, you know, I had young kids at the time, and it was like I was starting to open up to the whole world about GMOs and how bad the toxic the food supply. And so it just made so much sense.
Right.
And, you know, I started taking everything I could on gardening classes and permaculture classes and orchards and forestry and just anything I could to learn, hanging out with barefoot crazies in the national forest. You know, how do they – they're not losing weight. I mean, they're doing okay out there, right? So how do they do it, right? You know, wild foods, trapping. And, you know, what's really interesting is as I really began to get skills in that area, I also really began to heal myself, not only on the physical level of all kinds of, like, I used to have severe allergies and all kinds of problems, but also just emotionally. When you can grow food and make your own medicine, and you have that direct connection with your earth, and you don't need a military industrial complex to feed you, there's something really healing about that. I mean, your sense of security, your connection, and it's also, you know, common sense, I think, comes from people who grow their own food. You really get a much greater appreciation for how the world really works from the natural perspective. So that's it. So I came in freaked out the way most people are now, and through the so I really don't mind that en masse we now have people that are all completely freaked out. It's okay. It's the beginning of a journey that ultimately is incredibly healing. So I will say one other thing is I totally underestimated in 2008 how much spending $1 trillion a year would. That was basically a Band-Aid situation. Like, mm-hmm. The situation we're in now is it. They don't have any tricks left. The debt's actually way higher than what they're talking about. We're talking about dollar collapse in some form. I don't know how it's going to fall out, but I can promise you that things are going to get a lot worse before they get better, but they will get better. So,
for sure, we're in uncharted territory now as they announce the Great Reset to deal with that giant can that they've been kicking down the road for over a decade now. No, you're exactly right. And I just want to really highlight, though, that what I love about what you said is that while there were these problems that you became aware of that then created fear in you, it was actually the process of moving towards the solution that sort of transmuted that fear into the, oh, this is a healthier, better way to live. And I feel better. So that's just a great, important thing to take away from that whole process.
It really is. There is something you can do about it. I mean, I can't do anything about who's president or you know, them shutting down this business or that business, or I can't do anything about, you know, all the political stuff, or, you know, I guess if they try to vaccinate me, I will be kicking and screaming on that one. But, you know, you can grow your own food. Mm-hmm. You can make your own medicine. You can generate love in your family. And those are the really meaningful things, you know, the really important stuff in life you got control over.
Absolutely. So let's hope that the same alchemical process is now kicking off, and all these people who are entering fear suddenly waking up to some extent are going to go down that same path and come out the other side feeling more enlightened, so to speak. But you, as someone that started off, we'll say early, right, several years ago, now have the head start. And so, again, let's leverage that experience as we enter this announced Great Reset, where they're shutting down the, you know, like you said, they're shutting down currency and the economy and changing the dollar. They're shutting down food production. I don't know if you saw this, but an article about activists in Ontario literally calling, because there were a couple coronavirus deaths, calling to shut down all agricultural production throughout Ontario in order to keep workers safe, right? So
yeah,
it's just the divorce between any sense of reality and how we, like you said, there's no connection to nature and how we eat anymore. And I don't think we've ever seen that any more blatantly than, oh, just shut down the farms, we don't need them. So
I've got a lot of my friends are actually small local organic farmers, surprise surprise, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, like one of them in particular, Lynn, she said, you know, one of her workers tested positive for COVID. Not like any signs or any problems or anything, but one. And right. So they all quit. And there she is. And like, she can't, you know, you need to have five people to run that farm. You can't do it with one. So, you know, that's just one example. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this spring, how many acres and acres and acres of fresh produce were plowed under because there just wasn't the migrant laborers, because we shut down the borders and didn't let any pickers in? How many crops were not planted because we just didn't have the labor to do it? So we are in, if we weren't going to have hyperinflation because of all the money they're printing, like, oh my God, like, did we just blow $2 trillion last month? Like, oh my God, that was a shopping spree.
Yeah.
I wish I'd have gotten some of that. Anyway, I mean, that's going to cause inflation. But the other thing of what you're just saying, like, there just isn't going to be that much food. The grains, I think, will be around, which is sort of a saving grace, except for that I don't consider the GMO grains that they produce actually food. Mm-hmm. But, you know, corn, wheat, and soy, those kind of things are so heavily mechanized. And basically, it's a way of taking fossil fuels and making them edible, although not nutritious or healthy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that may be around for a while, but none of the real stuff like meat and vegetables and fruit and, you know, nuts and things like that. So it's crazy, crazy, crazy.
It is crazy. It's staggering. And but so we have lots of people who are now suddenly interested in growing their own food. And I think even more importantly, because they're shutting down all of this food production, this is also a call to action. People mm-hmm. have to, I mean, we got to get down to business and start growing our own food and provide a soft landing, mm-hmm. some sort of transition from this food shutdown that's going on out there. And so the big question today for you is, how do we do it?
How do we get started? Well, let me tell you the punchline and the good news first. Growing half of your own food is actually really pretty easy. It really doesn't take that much time. It's about an hour a day. And we have a whole thing on, if you go to growhalf.com, there's a whole video, and then I've got a bunch of ebooks and all kinds of stuff we're giving out for free just to get people to be able to do this, because this is a worldwide crisis, basically. And it's a three-part system, and it's very small. It's something anybody could do in a backyard size space. And that would be like a 100-square-foot garden. So that would be maybe two raised beds, which are 50-square-foot raised beds. It would be a flock of chickens with six laying hens, and then a small rabbitry with one buck and three breeding does. That is all totally doable by anybody. And let's say we're doing it right now. It's July. Probably not a good time to start a garden in, you know, Vermont, chickens or get started with the rabbits. Let me step for a minute just to inspire you about the chickens. A laying flock of six hens, a good hen in her prime, which is about when she's 2 years old, will produce about 250 eggs a year. So if you have six laying hens, that's 1,500 eggs a year that you're going to be collecting. So that is three egg omelets for you for every single day of the year. It's like platters of, I love deviled eggs, you know, right? You go to parties, you go to potlucks, and you should be going to parties and potlucks. Like, we have to stay connected. So bring that platter of deviled eggs, and then it's also dozens and dozens of your own eggs for barter or for trade or for gifts. Like, six hens in the backyard, and they're eating a lot of your vegetable scraps, or they're eating a lot of your scrap food anyway. They're eating insects. Unbelievable. In fact, Patricia Foreman, who is the author of a book called City Chicks, which is not about women. It's about chickens in the city. She laughs. She goes, someday I'm going to write a book about sex in the city with the chicks. And I'm like, Lynn, oh, Pat, please. Okay, calm down. She's always got these funny metaphors. She goes, Marjorie, may the flock be with you. I'm like, okay, Pat, let's just calm down here. Anyway, she's saying if one in three families had a backyard flock of chickens, we could eliminate the commercial egg production industry in the United States. Wow. Yeah. And if you've ever seen any of the pictures of those poor hens housed in horrible condition, it's just disgusting. I can't believe that we as a species do that. It's just disgusting. And it's so simple. I mean, really, one in every three families could have a flock of chickens. It's not undoable, right? That's totally doable everywhere. So
very low maintenance. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and you're exactly right. And it really, actually, it's one of the things that really bothers me is that, you know, I don't take any credit for the factory farming or for those disgusting egg farms. You know, all of these industrial animal agriculture that's been stood up is horrific. And I don't think anybody, you know, to your point, has chosen to do that. I think this has been the big companies doing that. But they're now pointing at these disgusting creations and saying, look, this is terrible. We can't do this anymore. We have to get rid of animal agriculture altogether. And here's some fake meat, and here's the synthetic dairy and all these things that we want you to be on that we control completely and that you will never be able to grow yourself. And so this is a bid for total control. But by virtue of pointing at these disgusting straw men that they have created,
their own problem they've created. Yeah, right.
And so what better? That's just a beautiful way of quantifying that it would only take one in three of us to actually take the time to go out and have a few chickens, you know, the very minimal time commitment, and completely undo that whole way of discussing farming and that whole argument. That's a fantastic way.
Chickens are amazing too. Man, when you start having a flock of chickens, like, you aren't going to need television anymore. They are hilarious. They are totally hilarious. I can tell you a great rooster story. By the way, you do not need a rooster. And in fact, if you live in a suburb or a city, do not get a rooster. I was in New York City, it was about a year or two ago, and I heard a rooster crowing in New York City. And I was like, not even Google would ever find that guy. I mean, really, like, you know, in the sound canyons of all those buildings and everything. And I am sure that there are thousands of people that do not appreciate a rooster crow. There's no telling how many people that are being pissed off by that rooster every day. You do not want to be the source of that. Mm-hmm. But I did have this one rooster. And I just got to tell you this story because it really shows the incredible value of growing your food that's way beyond the eggs. And so at that time I had a free range flock, and we can go into different ways to keep your chickens. I had a free range flock, and they would roost up at night, and they're a pretty low maintenance way to keep chickens, which is what I was into because I didn't have a lot of time. And I'd had some temporary electric fencing that was not charged up, and Buddy, the main rooster, got tangled up in that by accident. And he would have died. I mean, he knew he was a dead rooster because the sun was going down and all manner of things that love to eat chicken come out after dark, right? So mm-hmm. bobcats and foxes and coyotes and raccoons, and they would just gladly rip him to bits and eat him. And I happened to be coming out for the evening chores, and I saw him hung up in there. And I very carefully went to him because I don't interact with him a lot, and I didn't want to freak him out because mm-hmm. I'm like, more than 10 times his weight, right? And so I gently disentangled him, and he kind of got his feathers all straightened up, and he ran to get some water. He must have been out there for a while. And then he ran to the flock, kicked butt with the junior rooster, reestablished his dominance, and then, you know, went on back to living. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. So the next day, I'm out in the orchard, and I'm out in the open in the middle of the day in Texas, out in the open. Maybe the chickens are smarter than I am. And I was weeding a little sapling. And normally the chickens at that time of day are just sitting under a shade tree lounging or taking a dust bath. Or they are not out in the sun. They're actually probably a lot smarter than I am. Anyway, Buddy comes walking, and he comes right out in front of me, just out of arm's reach, you know, like maybe 3 feet away, right in front of me. And he stands there for a minute looking at me until he's sure he's got my attention. Now, chickens have eyes on the side of their head, so when he's looking right at me, it's kind of like this. It's kind of funny. Anyway, he's looking right at me, and then he very deliberately walks in a circle all around me while I'm, you know, squatted down on the ground there, all around me, just again out of arm's reach. And then he goes right back to where he was, and he lowers his head, still looking at me, and he scratches a little bit. He looks at me one time, and he walks off. And I knew in that moment he was thanking me for having saved his life, you know. And that communication was so beautiful. I'm almost going to cry because I just love
it. It is, you know, profound. It, yeah.
It's so profound. Everybody who has chickens has stories like that. It's just amazing, the connection. So growing your own food is such a beautiful thing, way beyond the absolutely fabulous omelets.
Yeah. Well said. Beautiful. Awesome. So I have explained a little bit about your three component system, the garden, the eggs, and the rabbits before in videos a long time ago. I've also shared, you know, John Jeevan's How to Grow Tons of Vegetables, because he does the calorie and the nutrition breakdown.
Yeah, and looked at one of the books piled up on my sofa over there.
Absolutely. Right here, yeah. And
yes, right on.
Carol Depp's the Resilient Gardener. Yeah, she's great. And she's, of course, she's got a slightly different breakdown where she talks about squash, potatoes, corn, beans, and eggs. And that's all that you need between calories and nutrition. And I shared these because it's awesome to hear. For one, I want people to know that there's no, here's how you do it. This is how you feed your family, period. There's no prescribed model. It's very flexible. And of course, it depends where you are. It's all about context. But I also wanted to just share, here are three very intelligent people thinking about the problem in slightly in different ways and sort of coming to different conclusions. So let's now dig, because you're here, into your more about your approach. And again, particularly in light of this renewed sense of urgency around what we're seeing with the food system and its imminent demise, how do we get the most bang for our buck in terms of the time that we are able to invest as this is going on? So making sure that we're focusing our attention in the right place. And before we even dig further into any of those three systems, I just want to like observe at stepping back, two of the three buckets are animals, right? So you've got,
yes.
Yeah,
I know. And we can have a conversation. A lot of people, and John Jeevan's is all his whole methodology is a vegetarian one. And I got to say, I love both John and Carol are heroes of mine. And we've all done interviews together, hung out. I mean, it's like a thing. And I wish I could spend more time with them. John specifically avoided animals because he wanted to be able to quantify things. And his work is unbelievable in terms of he could quantify, here's how many ounces of seeds you need. Here's what the germination rate is. Here's what you can grow in 100 square feet. And here's the yields you're likely to get when you're a beginner, when you're intermediate, and when you're advanced. He could really quantify that, which it makes it a lot more easier. When you start to add in animals into it, it becomes a little harder to be that rigorous. So that was one of the reasons that he chose to stick with vegetables. And Carol's into eggs. I mean, she's got her whole duck flock going on. And a lot of people give me so much pushback about rabbits. They're like, oh my God, you're going to kill the bunnies. And I said, yes, I am going to kill the bunnies. You know, that years ago, when Mama used to say, go get me a chicken, she told the kids, go get me a chicken. What she meant was go out to the flock and pick a bird and, you know, process it and defeather it and gut it and bring it to me ready to be cooked. That's what Go Get a Chicken meant. I mean, everybody knew the basic skills of butchering small animals because that was something that everybody did. I mean, that was a part of chicken dinner on Sunday, right? You know, there was a lot more hunting. There was a lot more just practical skills and knowledge. And you can do it. And actually, of the feedback that I've gotten from the first video I did called Grow Your Own Groceries, it was section 4 was the one on how to butcher rabbits. It's when you really do it with a beautiful way and in a good way. I mean, I had tons of vegetarians even saying, look, you know, I could do this if I had to, seeing as how the care and love that you brought to that. So, you know, rabbits are prey animals. They know what their purpose is. We are, humans are the ones that have this whole conversation about it. But really, you're going to get way more calories from animal products than you are from vegetable products. It's also a lot easier to grow animal products than it is to grow vegetable products. And I can give you a quick example of that. Okay. In your garden, and I don't want to discourage anybody from having everything. We need diversity. Like, you need diversity, right?
And your community needs diversity. Yeah.
Absolutely. And your community needs diversity. So you want to have gardens, orchards, chickens, rabbits. I mean, you want to have as much going on as you can manage at a time. Don't do it all at once. But anyway, so your garden, you need to be monitoring it to water it, to know when to water it and when not to water it. If it gets too cold, you need to be out there to cover it. And when it gets too hot, you need to uncover it when the sun's out. You need to bring the fertility to it. You know, there's a certain amount of work that's associated with a garden. And then also, you know, there's the planting and then the harvesting. And, you know, there's a certain workload. Whereas with rabbits or chickens or some of these small livestock, you can set up automatic water systems. You can take a little 5-gallon bucket with a float valve, and then you only need to look at that once a week, make sure it's clean and filled, have 2 or 3 of them so you have redundancy. But like, that chore turns out to be almost nothing, right? A lot of these animals, one of the reasons I wanted free range chickens was I don't want to open a coop in the morning and put them up at night. They go up in a tree and they handle that, and they come down in the morning when they want to. They forage for a lot of their own food. They forage for their own grasshopper. Less demands on me to feed them at any particular time, or if I want to leave for a weekend, they're probably going to be fine. You know, that kind of thing. They, if it gets too hot, they go in the shade. They move over there. They do that, right? If it's too cold, they go out in the sun. So they don't need nearly as much work as gardens do. So animal products by far are easier to produce than vegetables, and they also are much more calorically dense. And I would also argue that they're also much more nutritionally dense. I know this is not also going to be a popular thing. When I'm 57 right now, and when I was growing up, it was a thing that everybody ate liver once a week, whether you wanted to or not. And I promise you, back then, I did not want to. But liver is unbelievably nutritional. I mean, you do not need your one a day if you're eating, you know, a couple of ounces of liver a week. Now, I would never recommend eating a liver from anything from the commercial food supply. I just don't do that. That's worse than toxic, right?
Yeah.
But something that you're growing in your own backyard, that you've yourself, that you know everything it ate, yeah, absolutely. That is going to be the most nutritious food. The other thing, egg yolks. People talk about, you know, when I say, hey, what do you think is the chicken? Is it, you know, people go, oh, the yolk. No. The yolk is not the chicken. The chicken is a little tiny microscopic union of the DNA of the cock and the hen. And the yolk is the primary food sac that turns that little tiny cell into a fully formed chick with legs and a beating heart and beak and eyes and even feathers. And that yolk has all the minerals and all the vitamins and most of the macronutrients and everything, being like a single cell organism to an entire creature. Plus, it has enough reserves to be able to get out of its shell and peck around for a day or two. If there's that much nutrition for a chick in a yolk, like, what do you think it's doing to you when you eat it?
It packs a powerful punch, yeah.
Exactly, right? So animal products have a lot of nutrition in them.
And they're also converting things that we can't eat into, like you're saying, nutritionally dense food. So it's, yeah, it's a win across the board. And then also they're exuding this fertility, right? The manure, all of the waste products that you take straight into the garden and grow up a next generation. How important, let me just ask this way, how important would you say in your mind are animals on a self-sufficient homestead?
I'd say they're vital. And in fact, I know quite a few vegans even that aren't going to eat the animals or the animal products still have animals in their cycle because you need that. You need the fertility, basically. Okay. It really does. Now, John Jevons has a system where he grows a bunch of plants that he composts. But, you know, like 60% or 70% of his system is just growing plants to compost. And you can completely reduce that space down to 50 square feet with a rabbitry and, you know, be producing meat and get that same kind of fertility.
Not to mention all the labor that you're putting into that space.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's a lot easier to take care of rabbits than it is to grow all those calorie crop or the compost crops, he calls it.
So thank you for that, because with establishing that they're vital for a self-sufficient homestead means that we can translate these calls for an end to animal agriculture to removing people's ability to feed themselves. That's really what's being called for there, I think.
Well, you know, I do agree with him that the mass animal, mass animal stuff, you know, it's disgusting. If you've ever been by any of those feedlots where the cattle are just knee deep in their own excrement and being fed GMO corn, it stinks for miles around those complexes. It's horrible. And then the confined animal housing operation, I mean, it's just creating toxic sludge that we don't even know. And the whole chain is broken. So I'm absolutely in agreement when they say we have to stop, large scale conventional animal agriculture, but small scale backyard or even small organic farms, the animals are beautiful. It's a part of a whole ecosystem. They're helping to regenerate the earth. They're helping the nutrient cycling. It's a beautiful thing. So, you know, like any argument or conversation, it's usually not nearly as black and white as sound bites and Twitter thingies will make you believe.
Sure, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and no one's, you know, I'm right there with you. No one would like to end the CAFRs and these terrible operations more than I would. I just want to be careful because they're already talking about how, you know, people are getting sick from backyard chickens and we should really be careful if we allow people to have poultry. And so they're already laying that framework where we're talking about ending factory farming, but their intentions are already laid bare. They're coming for the food. Let's now dig into those three buckets. You want to start with the rabbits?
Sure. You know, a buck and three breeding doe and you'll produce about 75 rabbits a year. All your recipes for chicken, it's pretty much identical. I mean, you can roast them, you can fry them, you can cut them up, stir fry them. Rabbit enchiladas. Many times I've had people over for dinner. I forgot to tell them it was rabbit. They just assumed it was chicken. I mean, really, you know, it tastes like chicken. It really does taste like chicken. And if you think about it, 75 rabbits a year, that's basically a rabbit and a half every week. So you're talking about, so my family of four, and I had a boy who ate a lot. Oh my God, he still eats a lot. Anyway, I bet you eat a lot. you boys, I don't know what it is about you. My daughter compensated by not eating much, so maybe it equaled out. But, you know, what we would do is we would, and the great thing about rabbits is it's human scale. So we would process one. And it takes me about 15 or 20 minutes. When you get really good at it, it's really only about 5 minutes, including the cleanup. But I tend to, anyway, I'm not as fast as I should be. Anyway, about 20 minutes, and the thing is ready for cooking. We'll eat a good chunk of it that night, either roast rabbit or whatever. And then what'll be left is still some meat and definitely the carcass and the organs. And I'll put that on the back in a stock pot, and that will be soup tomorrow. So you don't need to even have any electricity for any of this. The stock pot is a tradition. Even my mom always had a stock pot on the back, and you know, you just keep it warm and heat it up every now and then to kill off stuff. So so it's two meals basically from one rabbit, and a rabbit and a half it actually meets the protein requirements for a family of four. And that, you know, growing protein out of plants is a little more challenging. It's
for sure.
It's kind of difficult to get that. In fact, John Jevons' methods, I love John. I'm not wanting to rag on him, but it's a very Spartan meal. There's hardly any fat in it, and it's very, very low protein, which is, I love protein and fat. Like, this is my favorites, you know, yeah. Please, you know, butter. So, you know, rabbits, the hides are very easy to tan. You can make all kinds of cool stuff with them. If you don't want to do that, feed it to your dog. Dogs love rabbit skins. There's still enough collagen and protein and whatever, and the fur will just come out in their feces somewhere. Hopefully they're doing that on the edge of your property. You know, they're just great. And I had two dogs that I used for protection for the rabbits and the gardens and everything. And I had two medium-sized dogs, so not too big and not too small. And the reason I wanted those was I wanted them big enough to be able to handle, you know, like a raccoon or a coyote or something like that. But I don't want them too big because I'm trying to feed them all from scraps and stuff that I've got, because I don't want to buy dog food. Like, what sense does that make, right?
Right.
So my dogs lived on eggs. They lived on entrails. They lived on random scraps and then whatever they could hunt or scrounge, which they did a significant amount of. So I very rarely ever had to buy dog food for them. So going back to the rabbits, I mean, that's a pretty good deal. I would recommend you start with hutches just because it's so much more controlled. You're learning so much. It's probably better for you to have as much controlled as possible. And then as you get more comfortable raising rabbits, you can be open them up, maybe have them in tractors on the ground or different pens. But I had a rabbit hutch for many years that was 2.5 feet wide by 20 feet long. And I had divided it into eight hutches. And one buck and three breeding does, and then four cages for growing out the babies. And, you know, it's a very simple system. I could feed more than half of their feed requirements just from tree trimmings and landscape trimmings and stuff. They're herbivores, so they primarily like to eat green stuff, which is, as you mentioned earlier, stuff I really can't eat. Mm-hmm. They're very quiet. They're very clean. They don't make any smells. You don't have to worry about your homeowners association because they're not going to know about it. You know, so.
That's perfect. I started keeping rabbits. I was looking for different ways to grow protein, basically. I'd already tried the spirulina, right? The weird algae, but that just wasn't the way that I'm going to use.
That's a tough way to get protein. I'm with exactly you on it, but it's tough, man.
Wanted to fully explore the solution space. But then part of the reason I started growing rabbits was I saw your Grow Your Half, and it really just sort of put me over the edge of like, okay, this is doable, and they're small, they're not intimidating, right? This is a good way to start keeping animals in this way. And I'm still doing it. And I've heard also from one of my subscribers who also started keeping rabbits around the same time. And I checked back with him not long ago and I said, you know, how's that going? And he said, oh, I had to shut it down. And I said, really? What happened? And he said, well, I already have two freezers and I fill them up and I don't have anywhere else to put all this meat. And so it was such a success story that I just really, really wanted to celebrate that.
They breed like rabbits.
Yeah, go figure. Yeah.
That's a great success story.
Tell me more about the diet. You mentioned that you're able to feed them grass. I definitely checked out Beyond the Pellet, which was like a great way to start breaking your conceptions around the corporate feeds and the fact that they're doing all the same big corporate practices that we're speaking ill of when we say we should be growing our own food. So if you go and buy their pellets, you're still feeding the beast, basically.
They like GMO'd alfalfa. Yeah. How could they GMO such a great plant that doesn't need any GMO at all? Like, Anyway, don't get us started.
let's keep moving. So tell me more about that. How did you experiment or find the right balance there? Did you move slowly? Yeah, tell me how you are able to feed your rabbits yourself.
Well, I really recommend in the beginning, just get a quality feed. Again, with your chickens, you know, just get a quality feed because you got a lot to learn. You got to learn, you know, about their everything, right? So just make it easy on yourself and don't try to do everything all at once. You know, go in small steps. So start out with some pellets and then... you know, after a while, like I would, it was so fun. I would be in the garden weeding and I had my rabbits right next to my garden because it was so fun. The rabbits would be like, yay, she's weeding. You know, you could see them running around their cages whenever I'd go out to weed because they knew that I would be bringing them the weeds. and you know, amaranth or lamb's quarters or some of these. I used to actually grow some trees just for them. Lucayena, it grows well in more warmer climates, and it's a high protein. It's almost similar to alfalfa. And I would cut them branches of that and just bring them stuff time when you do your pruning for your fruit trees. They love all the trimmings from that. I mean, that's what they eat in the wild is bark and stuff in the winter, you know, and in the spring when the new things come up, they're eating the bark of those new saplings and stuff. So they love those shoots. I mean, really, there are rabbits in Antarctica. There's rabbits in the desert everywhere. I mean, there are rabbits everywhere. So there's always ways to find foods for rabbits. So, you know, just start experimenting and adding more in. It does take a little bit after a while to really get it all dialed in because they do need, you know, protein and different requirements just like we do. And often you can't feed them too much of one thing.
Right.
Like I was feeding them too much of that Lucayena and it has mimazine in it and their hair started falling out. I was like, my goodness, something's going on here. You know, cut back on that, right? Yeah. But that's the cool thing. That's also one of the big distinctions between herbivores versus. So some people say, well, why don't you grow chickens for meat? And actually, my family does grow chickens for meat on a yearly basis. We'll make it a family project where for 3 months we raise up these chickens and the whole family processes and we got in the freezer for the year. But I really don't recommend meat chickens per se. And the big reason is rabbits are pure herbivores, so they are mostly only going to eat stuff that you weren't going to eat anyway, whereas chickens are more omnivorous, and it's more of an expensive meat. So they like to eat grains, they like to eat all kinds of stuff that you like to eat. The same thing with pigs. Pig pork is actually a more expensive meat to raise because they like, you know, they like a lot of the stuff that we like. So if you look and read in a lot of historical homesteading type stories or books, you wouldn't raise that many pigs. It was kind of expensive to raise them there because it's harder to get the food sources for them.
Mm-hmm. Prohibitively expensive to feed them. Yeah. Okay. Let's address one question that I get about the rabbit front. And that is, you know, the rabbit starvation, the protein poisoning that people mention.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that the fact that you're not getting enough fat, or is there something else we need to consider here?
Yeah, that is you're not getting enough fat. And usually what that is for people who are in survival situations and they're only eating lean rabbits and that's primarily their only diet. Mm-hmm. And then basically they eat too much protein and they, you know, overdo it on their kidneys and they have kidney failure. I suspect if they ate more of the organs and if they ate the brains and if they ate the skin and the actual intestinal linings, they probably would not have had rabbit starvation because there actually is a pretty good, and also the marrow of the bones. Mm-hmm. But most people who are in a survival situation are not doing that. Also, my rabbits tend to get real fat, you know, and yeah, because I procrastinate on butchering. I'm like, oh, I just don't want to do that today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you look good. Well, I'll let you sit in there for another while longer because my rabbits tend to get way too fat. But, you know, it's not
which would alleviate this problem is the point, yeah.
Yeah, so the rabbit poisoning is really just about some very specific survival scenarios, and it's not at all related to eating, you know, not you eating a healthy diet and also eating healthy raised rabbits that actually have a pretty good, you know, fat content to them and as well as a diversity of other items in there.
Diversity, definitely. Okay, let's move on to the eggs.
Sure. As I was saying before, six hens, 1,500 eggs a year. I would always recommend they are flocking animals. So to have a hen by herself is a cruelty, you know, and really even two hens is a bit of a cruelty. Really, flocking animals do like to have more of their own kind around, and it's very simple protection. I mean, they are small creatures, and they have got, you know, they're always looking around for hawks or predators or things, and there are lots of things that like to eat chickens, and they so have do have... You know, I would say three is the bare minimum. So, and having more is a little bit more makes life easier. For their lives are less stressful when there are more of them around. And if you have a rooster, which I was talking before, if you're in the city, don't have a rooster. Right. But if you have room for a rooster, they really do protect their hens. Mm-hmm. You'll see a free-range flock of chickens, and the rooster is up, and he's looking around all the time, and the hens are down eating. Or if he finds a big worm, it's amazing. Those guys know math. I have seen a rooster divide up a worm into enough pieces for all of his hens and give one to each hen, you know. And I have seen roosters, if there's been an attack in the middle of the night, it's almost always the rooster who's gone. And I have seen roosters attack predators, and they really defend their
themselves on the line. Yeah, it's
amazing. They really do. And so if you can have a rooster, they're great for that. But they also are very noisy, and if they can be mean, you know, for a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old to go out and deal with the rooster, and it's sort of a farm initiation for any kids who are raised on that. So there are some downsides to that. But chickens are awesome, and again, you know, if they're egg-laying chickens, then you can have a much more intimate relationship with them, because you're not likely to be eating them, and it allows you to have more. Much more of an intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. And also delightful, you know, just all the antics they get into and their personalities and all the different breeds we have you can play with. Oh, regarding breeds, one of the best ways to decide if you're just going to start having chickens, I would recommend the way to decide what breed to have is to look overall at your climate. You're wanting them for egg laying. And so you're going to want to try and get a breed that will maximize the amount of eggs that they'll grow. So we'll go over a little chicken anatomy. The fleshy stuff on the top and then under the chin, which I hope I don't have too much of one myself, it's called a comb and a wattle. And the bigger those appendages are, the more heat it can dissipate. Mm-hmm. So chickens that have big combs and wattles tend to do better in hotter climates. And then if you have a chicken with like a big wattle or a comb up in the north, then that actually can get frostbitten and can be a big problem. So you want chickens that have very small ones. The other is, just like humans, you know, if you have somebody who's very slight, they tend to do better in hotter climates. And somebody who's maybe a little meatier or bigger bone can handle colder temperatures. And the main reason you want that is when it gets colder, the hens tend to lay less. And if a hen is really struggling, she's not going to lay at all. So that's why you really want to try and match, you know, if you're up in Connecticut, then you're going to want a very little comb or wattle and a bigger body chicken. So just a little bit on chicken anatomy to help you pick one. And then other than that, I mean, and there are exceptions to everything. I don't know how many people I know who have chickens in God knows where and they're doing just fine. But, mm-hmm. you know, as a general tendency, try to pick it that way. And there's so many wonderful breeds. They're just amazing and delightful creatures. So have fun with that. Oh, another factoid people often want to know about: the color of the shell does not have any real indication on the nutrition. So mm-hmm. brown shells, blue shells, speckled shell, white shell, that's not what makes the difference. It's what the hen ate. And often the yolk is a real good indication of that. The more insects they get to eat, the brighter orange their yolks will be. Be careful in commercial fed eggs, because I've seen some feed places where they'll sell feed to the farmer and they'll give them a color palette and they say, what color yolk would you like to have? And they just manipulate it through.
That's cheating.
Ingredient. Yeah. You know, right. Yeah, right. Exactly. So, you know, but again, you know, those yolks have so much nutrition in them. And so, you know, I mean, Rocky Balboa, he can't be wrong, right?
So are the eggs then the, is that the main source of fat in these three components? It is.
The eggs have a lot of fat in them, but also the rabbits actually surprisingly have a lot of fat in them, especially if you're raising them in a more sedentary relationship, which you will be either in cages or tractors or some pen type situation. Okay. They do have, and the organs are high in fat. Yeah.
And so I know this is a, you know, it depends on context. This question is, you know, how do we feed, can you free range your chickens and how many? And that's a function of like the carrying capacity of your land, especially if you have a dry season, like you need to think about, well, maybe you can keep as many as you want in the spring, but then when things get a little sparser, how does that going to affect things? So how do you recommend, especially given our sense of urgency, how do you recommend trying to strike that balance where, you know, you don't want to depend on commercial foods, but, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I would say in the beginning, definitely go buy some decent feed and make mm-hmm. that less one less thing you have to learn about in the beginning, because you're going to be learning about, you're going to be starting new habits of watching them every day and opening coops, or, you know, figuring like, oh, my God, they figured out how to get out of that, or, oh, my God, something just ate this. How did it get in? I mean, you've got a lot to learn. So try mm-hmm. not to have feed be the first thing you try to become self, you know, buy the commercial feed. It's still chicken feed right now. It's going to uh-huh. become exorbitant. But eliminate that as being one of your problems right now. And there's lots of ways to feed your chickens. There are a lot of different ways to keep chickens. I have often had free range chickens. And I really like that. There's a couple of things to know about it. One is you definitely have to have a way to protect them. And as I said, I had two dogs. I trained them to live up in a tree at night. And I had two dogs that would patrol the ground underneath it at night. So that way they were safe. If you don't have the dogs, you're going to lose, because raccoons and even foxes, believe it or not, climb. Bobcats mm-hmm. certainly climb. So you'll lose them. So you have to protect them that way. Also, free-range chickens, there ain't no way to say this nicely, but they shit all over everything. You know, they can be a mess. Mm-hmm. They also can tear up all your mulch and stuff, and you'll have to fence your garden away from the chickens. So just some caveats about free-range chickens. Depending on how much room you have, they can either work out great or not. If in any livestock, a lot of people do a coop and run situation where they have a coop and then they have a little fenced in run area, and that's great, but be aware that that run area is going to turn into bare dirt very, very quickly.
Amazing.
And we call that a sacrifice paddock. It's just an area where they can get out and get outside and move around. And the ideal thing, I think, is to have a coop with a little sacrifice paddock and then like two or three other paddocks that you only give them access to once every while, you know, you rotate the access to it so that those paddocks have time to regenerate and grow mm-hmm. things. Because the first thing they're going to do when they get out is eat their favorite stuff. And they will quickly eat all of that down to nothing, to where it won't grow again. You know, how much room do you need? Yeah, you're right. It's so dependent on climate and what grows. You know, some people with large, like my in-laws have a big half-acre lot. They can actually have a flock of five or six chickens, keep them in the coop, and they can let them free range all over their yard. And those chickens can't eat, they can't keep up with all the stuff that grows there. Wow. So they actually do pretty well that way. But I think, and then I have another friend who doesn't have a lot of room, and so he just has a couple of areas that he keeps fenced off from the chickens, and he lets them in every now and then and just lets them go in there and eat. And then he kicks them out after 15 or 20 minutes. So that way that area can just stay green and lush mm-hmm. and continually be a source. Another thing about your garden, you're not going to want your chickens in your garden on a regular basis, but between seasons, they're great to let mm-hmm. them go in there, clean everything up, eat bugs, kick things, poop on stuff. They're really great in transition, but you're not going to want them during your growing season, because they're going to eat it.
They'll tear it up. Yeah, absolutely.
They tear it up.
Perfect. Before we go on to garden, so we've hit rabbits and chickens. Are there other animals that didn't make it into the three component system, but that are worth mentioning? I've heard, you know, maybe this is a legend of the fastest way to become self-sufficient is just to have a single cow for a family. Do you buy that, or anything else worth mentioning here?
I think a cow is great, but for mm-hmm. a lot of people, they're not going to have the... Yeah. Yeah. You know, the land, you know, in a place like Puerto Rico or Costa Rica, you can actually have a cow on like an acre or two because the rainfall and the grasses, it's so abundant here. In Texas, I mean, it was at least 10 or 20 acres to have a cow to be able to have enough grass to feed it, right? So it just depends on where you are and how much room you have. A family cow is awesome. And, you know, then there's the potential for milk and calves and stuff. So, I mean, that's definitely a great one. But also, you know, a buck and three breeding does will produce as much meat as a cow in a year, but it does it at a rate that you can actually process it. I'm going to tell you, butchering a cow is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do it. We send it to the processor because that's a lot of work and really is best done by two or three families all working together. So it's, mm-hmm. you know, there's that. There's a ton of other opportunities, quail for like mm-hmm. apartment dwellers. You know, you can actually grow fodder for them with little fodder systems and then have quail and have little eggs and they make a beautiful chirping sound. And you can even do that, like I said, up in the north in apartments. Pigeons, some people love to grow pigeons. Gosh, they're not hamsters or gerbils or whatever. Oh, guinea pigs. People like to raise guinea pigs for meat. We know one of the easiest food sources, if you have it again, is fish. You know, a pond. If there's any way that you can have even a quarter acre pond or something like that, you can grow a tremendous amount of fish. And that's really one of the easiest food sources ever is just mm-hmm. having a pond with some fish in it. Just so
get stocked once. Yep.
Yeah. Right. There's a lot. Yeah.
Awesome. Let's move on to the garden.
Well, I loved John Jevons' method, the biointensive, grow biointensive method where he's using the hexagonal spacing. Mm-hmm. A key thing about gardening is to remember that you're going to need to replenish that soil. If you're growing intensively, you've got to be adding compost intensively. And that's a good mm-hmm. reason for having your rabbits and your chickens producing fertility for you. Get about a pound of potatoes per square foot. So 100 pounds of potatoes, which takes 4 or 5 months to grow. You know, that's going to be like a pound of potatoes is a lot. Like a half a pound of potato is a great serving. So it's like 200 servings of potatoes for 4 or 5 months out of a 100-square-foot garden. That's a pretty good deal, mm-hmm. you know. I really see the garden being more full of all kinds of diversity. It's the whole rainbow idea of nutrition. You know, the more different colors you have, the more different nutrients you're going to get. So you got carrots and beets and kale and spinach and squash, and you got blues and greens and yellows and oranges and purple and all the different colors, so that way you're eating a lot of variety of nutrients. And I really see the garden as being more of a diversity of nutrient density. You know, and you know, if you want to go for the caloric density, it's going to be those potatoes, squash, beans, that kind of thing. A corn. Mm-hmm. Corn actually really needs a little bit more than 100 square feet. But, you know, and there's nothing more fun than having a garden and watering those plants and talking to those plants. And, you know, there really is. I've had some of the most delightful moments when I was growing corn patches, and I'd have like a 300 square foot corn patch. And the corn and the human relationship goes back for thousands of years, and you can feel it. Like when you grow corn and you sit in the corn patch and get still, you know, the corn knows that you grew it and that you'll be saving its seed and growing it again. The corn knows that you're in relationship with it. And you know that you're going to have a full belly this winter because of this corn. And there is a real thing that goes on between the two of you in this dance. And you can really it's really easy to tap into with the corn plant. So I think all of us, all the plants we connect with, we have that. But corn especially, it's just a wonderful mystical experience you can have.
Beautiful. And so you started answering already. One of the most popular questions was, what do I grow in my garden? So are we talking here? Are we talking about flower corn or sweet corn?
You know, actually both. Yeah. A lot of the flower corns, if you catch it at the right time, you can eat it fresh as sweet corn. Mm-hmm. What to grow first? To be honest with you, I love growing sprouts, which you don't even need a garden for. And then, you know, like you've got food in 7 days and mm-hmm. it's just this beautiful, vibrant, fresh food, man. You've got, and it's not huge calorie, but boy, that nutrition is just so bursting. And it really just enlivens me.
Getting the experience with something growing, right? Just learning, seeing this is like the most tender age of a plant and watching it through that it's really informative. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say grow what you love. And mm-hmm. there's two parts to that. So, you know, if you love pizza, well, grow some tomatoes and basil and onions and, you know, grow the ingredients, figure out how to grow mushrooms. I mean, grow what you love. If you, you know, if you love beer, well, figure out how to grow hops and barley, and then send me a few pints when you actually produce it. You know, I was on an interview the other day, and this guy just lit. You could tell he wasn't into the gardening. When I said, "Look, why don't you do that?" And he was like, "I could tell he was going to go dig something up." After we got done with the show, you know, but you know, really, if you love culinary mushrooms, you know, grow mushrooms, grow what you love. And then on the other side of that is that. So one time I was volunteering to teach a gardening school with these kids. These kids thought a Lunchable was a big deal, right? They had never eaten vegetables. The only thing they were eating is like that horrible iceberg lettuce with like this pale, sad excuse for a tomato. They thought that was vegetables, you know? Mm-hmm. So I planted the classics, which are strawberries and sugar snap peas, because I knew that would be guaranteed that they would love those. But then I also we had lettuces and chard and broccoli and mustards and turnips and radishes. And what I did was I got them little cups of ranch dressing and I put it in the fridge of the classroom. It was a small school. And I said, "Hey, you guys, whenever you want," and I showed them how they could take a little cup of the ranch dressing and dip a leaf in it and eat it. And I said, "Whenever you want to come out here, you can do that." And I was shocked how that became a thing at recess, was they were all grabbing that ranch dressing and they loved it. They just loved it. And then eventually they didn't even need the ranch dressing. You know, they were just between games of hide and go and stuff and tag. They were out there munching on the leaves and real food. So if you've never grown your own food, you may not know who you love the most, right? So, you know, your own zucchini, you might be like, "Man, I'm telling you, grocery store zucchini sucks. Don't bother." Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you grow your own and it's really enriched soil and you've been talking to that plant and loving on that plant, that zucchini is going to be something you have never tasted before. So it may be a little bit of, you know, you got to grow some and try it out. And then definitely if you do know you love some, grow it. But there's this factor of love that is so important in every one of these systems, but especially in the garden of really, plants definitely respond to how you feel about them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Now, what about for growing things for medicine? What kind of herbs do you like to grow?
You know, actually, a lot of my medicines, I usually wildcraft. A lot of them are just usually growing around, right? Mm-hmm. I don't really grow a lot intentionally for medicine. Some comfrey, like I like to grow some comfrey just because I like to make these nourishing infusions, and comfrey is just pretty dang near a weed everywhere it grows, mm-hmm. So it's really super nice. Oats and oat straw, again, really high in magnesium, and it's a great soothing drink in the evening, especially for those adrenal glands. You know, so oats and oat straw, if I can't find it. But a lot of stuff I actually just, you know, like walking down the alley, I saw a whole bunch of what do they call prickly lettuce, and it makes a great painkiller. So I would just harvest a whole bunch of that and make it. Or just so much, so many of them I just see and do that. Now, you definitely can grow your own medicines, and some people really get into that more than the growing the food. Mm-hmm. But a lot of time, a prickly pear is, when I'm in Texas, is one of my favorite plants. It grows everywhere. You don't need to grow it, right? You know, it's mm-hmm. always available. So I often wildcraft a lot of my own medicine rather than intentionally plant it and grow it.
That's perfect. Yeah, the giant medicine cabinet outdoors. Okay, give me a sense for if we, like, what's the breakdown, I guess, by space in terms of, are you growing for yourself? We mentioned Jevons ends up growing a lot of things just to be able to compost and feed back to his soil. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of, like, String Bean Farm out in Petaluma has this rule of we grow half for humans and half for the farm. So different people strike the balance in different ways, and I'm curious how you strike that balance, and then also how other people in the Grow Network, you know, what you're hearing.
Gosh, you know, I think we have pretty much every spectrum yeah. of what everybody's doing. Gosh, you know, I had never thought about the balance of it. I mean, usually I'm looking for food production for my family first, and then whatever's left over, it's, you know, for the chickens or rabbits or wildlife. Uh, Yeah, I hadn't really thought about a balance of what it's about. Now, I have never wanted to be a commercial farmer. So when I have excess, you know, I'm either giving it away or we're trading it, or so I'm usually not into selling it. And there's a lot of overlap between people who grow their own food and then people who are small organic farmers. I mean, a lot of the techniques are similar, but there is a difference also. And to be honest with you, I never wanted to deal with people who grow food to sell. There's a whole different regulatory, legal situation that I just never wanted to get involved with. I'm not interested in understanding laws. So I've always just wanted to focus on backyard producers and backyard production for family consumption.
Okay. So you haven't taken a part of your garden and dedicated it to alfalfa for the rabbits, for instance?
Not really. You know, we do plant, like I said, sometimes I'll plant trees for them or a lot of the other fruit, like peach trees. They love the leaves. You can just harvest branches of that to give to them. You know, I actually, you know, a lot of the landscape we have is partly for the rabbits. It's also partly for, you know, we may, like I used to plant a mulberry, have a mulberry tree that when the mulberries drop, that's, you know, we run the chickens over there, right? So, you know, yes, absolutely. And I hadn't actually quantified that. So it just seems so natural to do it. I hadn't thought of it as actually something to do, right? Yeah, thank you. I'll think about that some more.
Perfect. When we talk about the garden, I talk about growing food a lot. So certainly we focused on the principles of regenerative growing and keeping really good care of the soil so that it grows good food for you. And then I've talked a lot about the importance of saving seeds, both because you want to keep these amazing heirloom genetics alive and because they learn, right? You're developing your own land race wherever you are. What else is important here in this garden bucket to cover? What's my blind spot for sort of the foundational advice for how people go out there and produce food?
Well, I think you hit the key things. Water might be another topic to talk about. The quality of your water does make a difference. Now, if all you've got is municipal water, then, you know, go for it. And if you can filter that in some way, that's better. If you can get rainwater, or even if you can just get a little pond and collect water and then pump out of that, that's good too. But the quality of water does make a difference. So that's one aspect, maybe. But you've hit the main ones. I mean, fertility, production, definitely seeds and seed saving. You're on the right track, Christian. You're doing good. You're very knowledgeable.
Awesome. Perfect. Thank you for that. Okay. So that is our wonderful grow half your own groceries in these three main buckets, the rabbits, the eggs from the chickens, and your garden. Thank you for that. And now how do we translate this into an actionable plan for the people who are getting this sense of urgency? Yeah. How do we get started?
Well, since it's the middle of summer right now, and most of us, I'm assuming, are going to be in North America, I would recommend at this point in time either focus on chickens or rabbits. And what I really recommend is focus on one thing at a time. Like, so let's say, okay, I'm going to get my chicken thing going, right? So, you know, figure out what kind of coop you're going to build. You know, there's tons of coop designs out there. Where are you going to put it? Your fencing, your predator protection, how you're going to feed them, where are you going to store the feed for them. I really recommend for laying hens that you just go to Craigslist and buy some hens who are laying right now. It sounds sexy and glamorous to raise up the chicks, but really you're talking about 5 months of a lot of unnecessary work. Go buy some laying hens. You know, I don't know what they're running now, about $25 a bird or something like that. Just try to get one that's just coming into its egg laying capacity, which means it's going to be about 5 or 6 months old. And then start getting that rhythm and cycle going and you'll probably have some losses or some experiences and get over it. Everybody has failures. Everybody loses a chicken to something, or they find a big snake in the hen house, or, I mean, you're going to have experiences, right? So plan on, you know, 3 or 4 months realistically to really get those chickens up and going and going. And then maybe the next thing you want to do is start working on the rabbitry, because we'll be into winter at that point in time. So where are you going to be able to put them that they'll be able to stay warm? Where are you, again, the same thing, their feed, their watering, their housing, their food source, the storage for things that you need for them. How are you going to set all that up? And then again, I would recommend go out and buy a buck in three different does, make sure they're all genetically different. They're not all like siblings from the same litter. And get started with that. And then you're going to, you know, you'll have some things to learn about that. There's some record keeping with rabbits, you know, you want to know when and breeding them. And, you know, there's some things to learn. So you're going to, again, want to take a couple of months to really do that. And then by that time, we'll be back into spring and then you can get started with the garden.
So and by then you'll have a lot of manure from those rabbits and chickens.
Absolutely.
To kickstart that as well. Yeah.
Yes. And you definitely, you're probably right. Before the chickens and the rabbits, you should start with the compost pile. So step by step, I can't tell you how many times I've seen people trying to do everything all at once and they end up with a huge mess. They get discouraged, they get frustrated and they quit. And then they, you know, it's just not good. So do something slowly and easily. You're building a new lifestyle. You're building new habits. It's going to take you a while to do that. And, you know, be gentle on yourself.
Which is difficult advice, I know, for people that are just coming into this and are like, holy crap, I got to respond to this right now. And that sense of urgency is overwhelming. But, it's much better to get these things set up one by one and really nail them and have an understanding of what you're doing rather than sort of flail across all of the friends at the same time. And just imagine, go ahead.
That does bring up a whole nother thing. And this is huge. And that is, you know, really, whatever particular religion or faith, or even if you're an atheist, you know, if you get in touch with that, you really want to do this and you believe ultimately in your own survivability and the faith of humanity. For example, I believe all these riots and stuff, I believe that if those people were not being paid, we would not have any violence.
Without a doubt.
You know, like, and I, you know, of course, Black Lives Matter. I think the whole race, and there is some residual racism, but I think for the large part, that's not really an issue in our country. That's something that's being manufactured. I really do genuinely believe in the goodness of humanity. And if you really come from that and live from that, and then you also, you're working with your creator and you say, okay, I'm working on my chickens. I'm going to get this up and going. And I believe that when the time comes for me to get the rabbits, you know, they'll be there for me, right? You know, I'll be able to do this. And it really is magical when you set your mind and your intention on something, how it will come to you. Mm-hmm. And to trust in that and know in that and have that feeling in your heart that you're being looked after and cared for as you're on this journey, it helps tremendously. It really does. I mean, people tell me, how am I going to grow my own food? I live in an apartment. And I said, look, tell the universe you want to grow your own food and you're open to suggestions and you'll be blown away by what the universe will send you. You know, oh my God, you have roof to the access. You have access to the roof, or some friend says, hey, I've got this yard, or, you know, all of a sudden things will open to you. And the same thing is true on your whole journey with all of this. So, you know, I know we do have believe me, I've been in panic and fear for sure. There's no doubt. But, I think really just taking a breath and trusting in a process that is greater than yourself is a hugely important piece.
And you'll feel it too, as you start to do these things, when you plant some seeds, or like the first time you have a volunteer plant where you're like, well, I didn't plant that tomato, where'd it come from? And it's just magic. And you get that sense that you're working with a force that's definitely on your side, and it feels great. It feels wonderful. Okay. I'd like to talk about, if you will, we've hit this three component system for growing half your own groceries. There's a fourth component that I know you're big on, and so I want to bring into this equation here, and that is community. So I don't think that, I mean, maybe you can, but for most people it's not practical to imagine that you can go it alone. Even just from a security standpoint alone, you really need to be teaming up with people. So talk to me about building communities, and especially in light of, you know, I think it's just difficult right now. We're in a fundamentally, there's all this disinformation, and you're mentioning the race nonsense that's going on. How do you build a high trust network in a low trust environment?
So, getting together and meeting now is a little bit challenging. One way that I really did successfully build a really beautiful self-reliant community, and we'll have to figure out how we could adapt this for this time, but I would once every 2 weeks or once a month, I recommend you get on a schedule I would offer something at a safe, neutral space like the community center or, you know, the cafeteria at the elementary school. There's a lot of spaces. I tended not to use a church space just because I didn't want to have the problem with, like, I'm a Baptist and I'm a Catholic or whatever, you know, right? Okay. So I tended to use non-denominational locations. And what I would do is I would have an event and a lot, you know, if I couldn't come up with anything interesting, I would just find a good movie like there's some series that are on gardening or on permaculture, and I would just show a permaculture video, right? And I would print up flyers and plaster it all over the neighborhood and say, go to the Red Rock Community Center on Saturday at 6 o'clock. We're going to show a movie on permaculture and it's free. It's open to the public. Refreshments will be served and, you know, bring your kids. And so I would also go buy a couple of bags of corn chips and make up a 5-gallon cooler of iced tea because it's such a, you know, if somebody has a little bit of food, even if it's just corn chips and iced tea, it tends to make it a social event and people are more likely to linger and talk to each other. And people who show up to these events are people who are interested in permaculture, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I actually took the kids outside and I was doing childcare while the movie was going on. And then after the movie was over, we would all hang out a little bit. And it's a safe, neutral space. I'm not telling anybody what preps I've got or what's going on. We would just talk about permaculture. And after a few weeks or a few months of doing this, I would begin to notice that, like, hey, the same 5 or 6 families were always showing up. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there'd be other people that would come and go. But after a while, you would really start to see and you'd start to build friendships and relationships. And then you would really start to know, oh, like, right, the Costells are totally in the same mindset. And we have a lot of values. And we've done all of this in a safe, neutral space where nobody has had to reveal anything. And you could even do it now with just make sure if you got social distancing issues and all that kind of stuff. And you could still do it. Right. And that was just a great way to build community. And then it also, plus it let, you know, people kept seeing these signs all the time up and it started to let people know that, hey, there's some people thinking about this now. After a while, we didn't need to host the events. I did continue to do it for a long time, but I mean, even 3 or 4 families, if there's 3 or 4 of you that are all kind of working together and you've got some similar stuff going on and you both have the same similar agenda, that is an amazing group right there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, just 3 or 4 families that are living within a mile or a few miles. In Texas, if you live 5 miles apart, that's close. You know, right?
You know, so, everything is bigger in Texas.
Everything is, oh my God, the amount of driving we did, it was unbelievable. But, you know, even just one family. So I had like rabbits and chickens, we had cows and I had a garden and some fruit trees. And then just one family that we befriended and they had goats, you know, they had their gardens and some fruits and stuff, but they had goats and pigs. And so just having that one family that we would work with together, you know, our food palette just almost doubled because now there was goat cheese and there was pork and there was, oh, he did honey. So we had honey and then they had rabbit and they had all kinds of, you know, I mean, it was just, I mean, really, it only takes a couple. And then we would organize work parties together. And as the trust level went up, you know, come on over to my place. And that happened. But it's a great, safe way to build it. Like I said, a neutral, you know, everywhere is a community. There's a community center everywhere, right, that you can use. And it usually doesn't cost anything. If any, you know, I mean, to put one of these on, the most it's going to cost you is. You know, $30 or $40, including the chips and the iced tea. And I would recommend is the number one way to start to build a self-reliant community in a safe way where you're not revealing too much about what you know, what kind of preps or other things that you might have.
It's a fantastic answer. Just give yourself that environment where the alliances can organically form. So, yeah. Great answer. Thank you for that.
It only takes a couple of months. It's really amazing how you'll see that happen. And again, just use movies that are good, that you like, that you're inspired by. You don't even have to get creative with, like, I would often bring in speakers and all kinds of stuff like that. You don't even have to do that. Just get some great movies and just, you know, yeah.
I love it. And and then you'll notice this is part of why we were saying up above, do what you can with where you are, whatever your context allows. And then as you form this community, you will find that the holes get plugged, right? You become this patchwork of different skill sets and different environments coming together, and it's just really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, and it really is amazing, the skill sets, you know, and how complementary. I mean, really, with just a couple of families, you're going to find all of you have a bunch, and it's such a sense of security. Years later, my husband and I were building, it's basically like a small cow barn, and I slipped and sliced open my leg with a piece of sheet metal.
Ouch.
I mean, huge gaping wound. And so fortunately, my daughter and I had just done a first aid training, so I knew what to do. But, you know, my husband's immediately on the phone and he calls the Knoxes. He says, hey, can you come over and watch the kids? I got to drive Marjorie to the hospital. And boom, you know, we had people there taking care of stuff, you know, just little stuff like that. Or when we were right in the heart of the Bastrop complex fires, were the worst fires I think the United States has ever seen. And our farm was right in the middle of that. And all the neighbors, we were organized. We communication, we had a phone tree. It turned out our farm happened to be at the highest where we built the thing up on the top of the barn where we could have a lookout so we could monitor the fires. And we were relaying information. In an emergency like that, communication is the hardest thing to deal with. But by having a community that had already been built, it just made it so much better. So, yeah.
That's great. And then also, when we're talking about community, what about local farmers and ranchers? What do you think are the best ways to reach out to them and support them right now?
Yeah, absolutely. You need to be doing that. Actually, that's partly how I got into growing food was to, when I first started to freak out, I said, I'm going to organize all the local farmers. And actually, there was a program the president of the Texas Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association lived in my county, and he said, I want to get local organic food into the element, you know, into the school system. And I said, great, I'm a community organizer. Let's do it at my elementary school, even though I'm homeschooling, but it's okay. You know, we want to get this going and I want to organize the farmers. And we had a couple of meetings and huge failure, and my life changed forever. And I'll never forget that night because I could not stop shaking. And the reason the thing failed, everybody wanted it. The school system wanted it, the teachers, the parents. There was grant money from the federal level and the state level. Reams of studies that show that when you eat good quality food, you're more intelligent and you're more capable. You're less behavioral problems. I mean, there's so many reasons to eat good food.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that caused the failure was there were not enough local farmers in all of Bastrop County, and Texas has big counties, to provide even part of the vegetables for one small rural elementary school. And when I realized that, and that we were an hour outside of Austin with a population of 1 million, 2 hours away from Houston with a population of 4 million, 2 hours away from San Antonio with a population of 4 million, 4 hours away from Dallas with a population of 3 million, everybody wants to eat, and there's only 4 days worth of food supply in the grocery store, and there's not enough organic farmers for enough vegetables for one small elementary school. That's when it just, like, my life changed completely. And I said, we have got to learn how to grow food, and farmers come from gardeners, and I'm going to learn to grow food. And yeah. And yes, we absolutely have to support our local farmers, and you'll want to, because you can't grow everything, and you're going to want, like, I want pork chops. And I'm afraid of pigs. So I want a farmer to grow that for me.
Mm-hmm. So just reaching out to them, making sure that that they're aware you're there to help in any way that they need help. That can be, you know, labor. I've told people, if you're a web developer, then a lot of people who lost their markets and could use help setting up a direct sales website right now.
Yeah.
If you're a lawyer, there's a lot of legislation that's in the way of farmers doing direct sales. Like, there's just any number, whatever your background is, definitely all hands on deck right now. We need you. I promise there are ways that you can help cut through these red tape and make sure that farmers and ranchers are able to keep producing the food we need. That's an astounding story about there not being, even in the country, not being enough food produced for one.
You know, when you and I, we live in the city or we live in the suburbs, we think that our worst case scenario, we're going to go out to the countryside and steal from those people. Right,
they have the food.
Like,
yeah.
If we're honest about it, right, that's kind of always our backup. Like, there ain't no food out there.
Yeah.
There ain't no food out there, And I was literally just shaking for hours. And then I would wake up for the next decade. I had panic attack. I mean, because it just, like, you can't imagine 10 million people starving to death in Texas. You know, that's not a real, and then my kids and all my community. And that was the whole reason that I went like crazy to figure out how to grow food. And then, you know, that was the fear and panic. And, and that's the genesis of the Grow Network, is like, we have got to rebuild the local food system, and it can't be all farmers. The farmers cannot grow. It has to have a huge component of backyard food production.
What does Marjorie, this is a broken system we're describing. So what does, after having thought about it for a long time, deeply, what does it look like, and how do we stand it up rapidly right now?
Well, backyard food production is an essential element, and I can give you a couple of reasons why. One is genetics. So organic farmers do not have time to do a lot of seed trials or figure out what grows or what doesn't. Us backyard producers do have more time and more space to play around with different varieties of tomatoes or different varieties of basil or what works or what survived that drought or what survived that deluge of water, and get that information to the farmers or help them, right? We also are the ones who are going to be much better at doing seed saving and saving of varieties. And in addition to the experiment, the same thing for all of our breeds of livestock. A lot of our breeds of livestock are endangered, like, because nobody's been raising rabbits for 50 or 100 years, right? Or chicken. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of chickens around. They've been doing pretty well. But pigs, everybody wanted lean meat for a couple of decades, so there's no pigs that actually grow fat, which is actually the most important part of raising a pig, is getting the fat. Mm-hmm. You know, we need backyard producers to be able to do that. Also, we just physically don't have the land. We need every bit of land being used, and that's your backyard needs to produce that food. It also makes more sense for a lot of the crops, like lettuce, that shouldn't be shipped anywhere. That should be growing right outside your door where you just pick it. You know, having lettuce travel doesn't make any one iota of a sense, yeah, you know. Yeah. So where people are growing a quarter or half or some percentage of their own food in their backyard or on their balconies or wherever, buying some from their local farmers, and then maybe, regional production of maybe some of the calorie crops or something like that. That's ultimately what a local food shed looks like.
Decentralized would be the word I would use to summarize what you were just describing, right? Everyone growing, all these, distributed growth all over the place. The more people growing, the harder it is to shut these people down. Yeah.
Yeah, there's that. There is that. Well, we're going to die if we don't do this, because the centralized food is toxic, and it's, you know, we're already seeing a die off in population. I mean, really, the CDC is saying 1/3 of our kids born after 2000, they fully expect them to all become diabetics. You know, like, life expectancy has dropped for 3 years in a row now. And I think it leveled off for 1 year, but that's about to go off a cliff. I mean,
yeah, that's a good, know. Yeah, that's an excellent point. This system has already failed, and that soft failure is now transitioning to a fast, hard failure. But and that's why this conversation is going on. So Marjorie, you talk to a lot of people, and I'm curious, over the last season or two or three, have you been hearing what have you been hearing? Certainly there have been challenging growing seasons around the country and around the world, but I'm just curious if what your sense is there.
You know, now people ask me a lot about the climate change thing. And to be honest with you, I know there's a lot of people that are, you know, there's a huge amount of science and I believe it. And then there's the other people that saying, no, it's a hoax. And to be honest with you, I am so disillusioned with every news source right now. I honestly don't know. But here's what I do know is that there are reports, farmers and gardeners all over the world, that things are not the way they used to be. For example, I was in Costa Rica a little while ago, and they said, you know, the rains used to start like clockwork on April 15th, and we have not seen that in a long time. We don't know when they're going to start. Or, you know, we used to know that the there was going to be snow here, and now we haven't seen snow here. I mean, in some ways, I see it that we're in such a turmoil and we're in such a collective change that, of course, it's going to be reflected in our climate and our weather. So, we are, you know, we definitely have to be able to grow and face a level of resiliency that was not a challenge that, say, our forefathers 100 years ago had. So we are going to have to really be more badasses than
well
they
said.
Were.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Any other interesting intel you're hearing from your network?
Gosh, you know, the latest thing I've heard is that the debt is far bigger than we all heard. I think what is the official number is like 16 or 26 trillion. And now I've heard it's actually more like 90 trillion.
That's right. Yeah.
That they've been spending all this money they have not been telling us about. And I'm like, yeah, that's why we're in this crisis right now, which mm-hmm. tells you this crisis is not going to end until the dollar has collapsed.
That's right. That's yeah. a great reset for you. Yeah, no, Catherine Austin Fitz has done some great research
yeah,
on those
Catherine,
missing trillions.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah. Her and there's an accountant. I'm trying to remember his name right now. Anyway, they're doing some really amazing work.
Tracing down those 21 trillion plus dollars missing. Okay, so I have a few questions about you, actually. And to close off, and so you mentioned that you came from fear, and while it ultimately served as a catalyst to get you to develop into a better person, into a better do better things, and be a healthier person all around, there were some years in that transformation. So how do you, in the short term, how do you fear works against you, it keeps you from imagining good things and building great futures. So how do you push it? How do you work with fear?
Yeah, well, I still work with fear a lot now. I mean, if somebody's not fearful right now, I would say they're asleep. They're going to be dead soon, right? You know, like you should be afraid right now. There's so much change happening.
Legitimately.
So the way I deal with fear is I just try to, the other side of fear is excitement and say, okay, well, you know, we're in a huge change. We're in a huge change. It's a tremendous change. And it's going to force a lot of us to live lives that we have not lived before, which is going to include growing food. Just this quote-unquote pandemic has really had people suddenly start to realize their relationships and the value of family and time together. What a blessing that is, you know. So I also really, I'm a huge fan of the work of Dr. Joe Dispenza, where he's talking about, and it's also a quote from, I forget which one of the futurists, but it's like, it's easier to create your future than it is to predict it. And so really work on a vision of the future that you want to live into and, you know, try to embody that as much as possible. So, you know, I'm seeing my kids around me and we're having a wonderful time and we're exchanging gifts at Christmas. And it doesn't matter whether the gifts are big or little, but the fact we're exchanging them or I'm sharing a meal with friends or, you know, I've got a beautiful garden and or my chicken flocks or whatever. I mean, I'm visualizing things of the world that I want to see and doing my best not only to logically define that, but then also to emotionally embrace it. And I find that an incredibly useful skill for creating or manifesting mm-hmm. what it is that I want to be in the world. I really think, I don't know if you saw, I had done an interview with Dr. Kai-Fu Lee, who is an expert at artificial intelligence. And if you look at the tsunami of job loss that we're going to have from AI, mm-hmm. This quote-unquote pandemic is just actually creating that wave of unemployment a little bit early. That was coming mm-hmm. anyway due to AI, because there's so much that AI is going to just replace for the human workforce. You know, how do we find meaning in our lives beyond that? And I believe the way we find meaning in it is through our relationships and through love and through these more spiritual aspects, is which something that we can do as humans that robots can't. Mm-hmm. Some of the work that I'm starting to move into that I'm very excited about is more and more interspecies communication, like working with plants. People talk about, oh, you're killing the rabbits. And I'm like, you know, I really want to work with asking the rabbits of who should I select or not select, or how should we do the breeding of the rabbits or the culling of the rabbits? You know, I think that the rabbits would tell us, you know, if we could begin to communicate with them. So I think there's so much more exciting work to come, so much exciting work with soil microbiology and actually working with life itself and energetics and other realms. There is that potential that is magical or mystical that we can tap into and use. And I think ultimately we're in here is some sort of a spiritual war of, you know, don't be afraid because the fear will kill you. Mm-hmm. But really do your best to love as much as possible. You know, take the practical steps to take care of yourself, but really relationships and friendships and love and security, work to build those things and focus on that. So, you know, unsubscribe from all the news feeds. You know, right? Except, of course, the Ice Age podcast. You know, right?
Unless they're offering solutions and trying to get you on the right page. Okay, great answer. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Like, imagination is an incredibly powerful force. You know, John Rappaport also talks a lot about how that is the weapon that we need to use in this. And that's why fear is being pushed so hard, is because it just disables that imagination. But if you're able to step out of that and fire it back up and then imagine the future you want to work towards and then start taking steps that direction, you'll find yourself closer to it every day. And that's just the way to, you know.
This is an idea that's coming up everywhere. And I think that's, you know, it's where we're at, right? We're coming to that reality. Like, either you're going to cave into the fear and die, or you're going to step up and say, wait a minute, I want to create another reality and I'm not going to pay attention to that. So, yeah.
Excellent. Marjorie, what do you do for self-care?
Gosh, you know, there are five things that I do every day. And one is, in the first thing in the morning, is I meditate or spend time with my creator, and I spend time working to manifest the day that I want to have, or the things that I, you know, the world that I want to see. At least an hour of meditation in the morning. I another thing is I'm really big on family, so I'm calling or texting my kids or sisters and brothers and family, and, you know, I'm always making sure that I've got friends, you know, working on those. It's not work, actually, but making sure I've devoted some part of my day to the connections of the people that are closest to me. My work is unbelievably fulfilling. I mean, what better job? You know, how ridiculous, we're going to stop the destruction of the earth. I mean, it's kind of silly. But on the other hand, it's incredible to be totally dedicated to something that you think is impossible, because it gives you this whole liberation for not caring about the results, but being fully committed. It's an extraordinary life, just amazingly beautiful. And then fitness, you know, I really love being physical, and I just love being able to do things with my body, you know, jump around or dance or move or walk. So I'm really into, and of course, good food, you know, so I love eating good food. So, you know, my whole life is mostly centered around those things. That's a pretty simple life, actually. For a while, I was watching all the news sources, you know, the Washington Post and the Times and the Wall Street Journal and all this stuff about the coronavirus. And I was noticing I was getting really, it was just really messing with me.
Yeah.
And I could not believe how bad. And the Washington Post was the worst. And I used to think the Washington Post was a great newspaper. Mm-hmm. They were the worst. I mean, talk about fear porn. It was unbelievable. I mean, like, every time I got done reading those articles, I'd have to, like, clear myself, you know?
Yeah.
So I've recently unsubscribed from all of that. It was like, forget it, you know, forget it, you know? So, so self-care of, like, management of information flow,
right? Being conscious of what you're bringing into your awareness. Yeah,
what,
absolutely,
you're absorbing. Yeah,
great answer. I love it. Okay, so before we close, and I want to hear a little bit more about the Grow Network and how people can support you, but you are the expert here for many years, and so I just want to again make sure, given the frame of we're entering the Great Reset, people are becoming aware that they're, you know, that we're entering economic problems, to say the least, and food shortages, and a lot of, you know, a different world, and they're watching their economic and their food systems crumble before their eyes. So I just want to make sure, any final advice that you have as we enter that Great Reset, just stepping back here.
Well, real wealth, we always think about wealth as being money, a house, car, you know, bank accounts, that's not really wealth. I mean, it's some subset of it, but real wealth is your health, and it's your family, it's your community, your relationships, doing meaningful work, and living a life of purpose. And all of those things that are real wealth, you can grow yourself in your backyard directly from the earth. So I think the great saving grace of this entire thing is that we still can do that, you know, that we do not need a military, governmental, industrial complex to support our needs. We can actually still source directly from the earth. So I see tremendous hope, and I get it. We're in an unprecedented change, and I really want to recommend everybody journal about it. Or I can't tell you how valuable reading the journals of people during Civil War or during Nazi Germany occupation to hear their thoughts on a day-to-day basis of what was going on for them. This is a very special time. It's not going to last that long. It'll be a couple of years at most, and then we're going to be into some other new normal. But, you know, right that day, your kids are going to want to, your grandkids are going to want to know, somebody's going to want to know about, you might think my life is so mundane, but you're really actually have an important voice and a contribution. You know, we have to, even if it wasn't because of this, you have to go to growing your own food just to be able to have the fundamental form of wealth, which is health. So, you know, why not get started now?
Yeah, it's the time. It's everybody, that's something everybody's got to be doing. And then, as I said earlier, on top of that, everyone's got their own unique skill set and experience that we all have to bring to the table right now to shepherd us through this. Great answer. So please do now tell us about the Grow Network and how to find you and it and how to support you and any other projects you're excited about. I'd love to hear.
Oh, awesome. Well, the Grow Network, it's an online community of people who are stopping the destruction of the earth via homegrown food. And yes, we're having this pandemic and there's all that going on, but fundamentally, commercial agriculture is the most destructive force on the planet. And there's, like, just as I was saying, one in every three families, and we could stop the commercial egg industry. You know, actually, I think if one in every other family had a big garden, then we could probably cut down most of the commercial produce. You know, I'm working on crunching the numbers. Amazing. And there's so much that you can do. There is so much that you can do. Treating infections without antibiotics, very simply done with herbal medicine. And then we don't have to have all that kind of stuff in our streams, killing our frogs and our fish and that kind of thing. So the Grow Network is just a really awesome group. We have a store with different products we sell. We have a really, really active forum full of all kinds of really experienced people. And I think it's like less than 38 minutes. If you post up a question, you'll get a response that quickly, and then there'll be 10 responses within like an hour and a half. So really active and engaged group of people, a lot of really great experience. We also have a monthly academy where we have all kinds of certifications on gardening and chickens and rabbits. And so if you don't want to have to wade through all that stuff on YouTube and you want somebody who's very acknowledged, just take you to step by step through setting all this up, you know, sign up for the academy. And you know, you'll get everything you need to know, and it's laid out very easily and simply, and you know exactly how to set up that garden, exactly how to set up that chicken coop, how to make home medicine, how to use home medicine, all kinds of, there's like 15 certifications, and we add one every quarter. Exciting projects. I've got a book deal with Penguin Random House, and that'll be coming out next spring. So that's pretty exciting. We got a contest going on at the Grow Network right now where people are uploading videos on how they grow half of their own food. So I can't wait to see those videos coming in. We got a contest happening. You know, we've always got a lot of fun stuff going on at the... Oh, I forgot. When there is no doctor, we have a training coming up in a couple of weeks. It's a three-day training on how to handle a gunshot wound, how to handle a severe burn, what to do about dental pain, how to make your own pain medicines, how to create a sterile environment for field surgery, how to do stuff when there is no doctor, literally. Like, you know, hopefully there's skilled people around and you'll just be an assistant. But if there was nobody, at least you would know you would know enough to probably save that person's life. And then what to stock up on? Like, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's disappearing right now. So that's coming up in July, and I'm really looking forward to that training. We're going to have it in person, and it's in Colorado, and if you can't make it to that, we have a digital version. We'll be filming it and recording it and making it available. So that's a super empowering training, and I promise you that's going to be some skills you are going to need sometime in the next few years, as hard as that information is to take.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we find all that at grownetwork.org?
Grownetwork.com. Yeah.
.com. Okay. Outstanding. Perfect. Thank you for that. Marjorie, you have delivered a healthy dose of inspiration and enthusiasm and optimism, I think, which is very much needed right now, as you always do. That's why I wanted to have this conversation, which I have genuinely enjoyed, and I cannot thank you enough for taking the
time.
Thank
you, Kristen. Yeah, thank you so much for what you're doing. I was really, really enjoying the piece that you had done connecting 5G and some of these other things on the food system that I wasn't aware about. So really appreciate, you know, how you're connecting the dots and getting the information out there also.
It's going to take all of us. I mean it, right? It's going to take all of us working together with our own unique weird skill sets, whatever our background is. It's a special time, and all of them are coming together in fascinating and beautiful ways. But yeah, we gotta get to it. So folks, you've just heard, Marjorie has described how we can check the box of protein production, which is a fantastic box to check. Just imagine having that taken care of, and then your garden becomes something that you get to be a little more playful with, a little more fun, rather than trying to stress out about all the time. So this is some fantastic information. Marjorie, thank you again for taking the time. And thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a huge thanks again to Marjorie for this conversation. And thank you for joining us. Remember, you can find her system at growhalf.com. And you can check out grownetwork.com for the remarkable network of people all working to grow their own food and improve food security. As I've called it, Team Grow. You can find that at grownetwork.com. Once again, thanks for joining us. I do genuinely appreciate your support. So if you find value in my research or in interviews like this one, you can find a few different ways of helping beyond, as always, just spreading the word at iceagefarmer.com/support. And again, I genuinely appreciate that. All right, folks, let's go build great things and grow abundant, delicious, nutritious food. Be well.